This afternoon, we are with Dr. Tim Kelly. He's here at La Trobe at St. Vincent's College, and he has just completed the book, The Transformation of American Catholicism, The Pittsburgh Laity, and the Second Vatican Council, 1950 to 1972. And by the way, it is put out by Notre Dame Press, my alma mater. Tim, you're on.
Okay. But so I should start with talking about how I came to
this. Yes, how did you come to write with this focus on the laity in Pittsburgh, and where does this book go? Okay. What is this about?
Well, let me start by saying I grew up, I was born in 1960, so I really grew up in the post-Vatican II church, or at least my memory of church is more post-Vatican II than pre-Vatican II. But one of the things I noticed pretty consistently throughout my time in church as a youngster was that there were lots of people, mostly older people, practicing things that I didn't know or understand, genuflecting at certain moments, or doing things that were clearly Catholic and clearly central to their understanding of how to behave in church. But I had never learned, and so they were alien to me. I knew how to do the rosary, and we did the rosary, but other kinds of things just seemed very odd to me. So I knew that there was a disconnect in some ways between those people who were in their 40s and 50s and younger people who were growing up as I was growing up. That had always sort of hung with me. Something big must have happened. And whenever anybody would talk about it, they said, oh, Vatican II, Vatican II. So I knew that there was something out there called Vatican II that had transformed the way people understood their faith and understood the way that they should behave. And so that sort of hung with me for a long time. And I'm a social historian, so I was in graduate school studying ordinary people. Social history is the study of history from the bottom up, from the experiences of ordinary people rather than starting with the presidents and generals and things like that. Looking at the experiences of ordinary people and trying to see big trends and transformations in behavior and what their experiences of important moments were. And even if we redefine important moments based upon their experiences. So as I was looking for a dissertation topic in graduate school at Carnegie Mellon, none of my faculty were Catholic or studied religious history, but this notion that I'd be interested in studying the ordinary person's experience of a great transformative moment in their lives came to me. I'm very interested in Catholicism, grew up Catholic, and have studied, did my master's thesis on Catholic reforms in the early 20th century. So I was thinking about a Catholic topic, and I thought, what bigger topic could I undertake than study of Vatican II? That is the big topic, at least at that time in the 1980s, that was what people talked about. If you were talking about Catholicism and Catholic history, you were talking about Vatican II and the transformation. So I decided to look and see what the ordinary layperson's experience of Vatican II was. And because I was in Pittsburgh, I thought I'd try and do a local study where I could look at parish experiences, and go to local parishes and look at their archives, and also look at the diocesan archives. It just happened that one of the big movers of the Pittsburgh church at that time had been Bishop Wright in the 1960s, and his predecessor was Bishop Dearden in Pittsburgh as well. So that it happened to be not only good because it was local, but also these were big movers in the national church scene and shaped the way that Americans experienced Catholicism pretty profoundly. And so it worked out really well in that regard for me as well. So I spent a number of years studying this, but I still came to this study with the notion that the Catholic experience, the lay experience of Vatican II was something that would have been imposed from above, that these reforms happened at the conciliar level, the bishops and the cardinals, and then was translated down into the lives of lay Catholics. And even I completed my entire dissertation really with that sense that the laity were reacting to changes that were imposed from above. And so the big questions were, how did the laity respond to these profound transformations? But then I finished my dissertation and I was continuing to do more research on the subject. And I turned my focus more, the resources, by the way, were very good in the archives for the 1960s and 70s and not very good for the 1950s. There just wasn't a lot of material there. So I didn't have a good baseline, and I thought I have to go back and read the Pittsburgh Catholic Every issue very thoroughly, do more work in the archives in the local parishes. And what I discovered, to my surprise, was that my story changed pretty dramatically. That looking at the 50s, I saw a version of Catholicism that seemed to be the normal story that Catholic historians would tell of a very devotional behaviors and very devotional church. But that in about 1954 in Pittsburgh, we see a dramatic transformation in the behaviors of the laity. We still have the same kind of messages coming from clergy and from the bishops that this is how you ought to behave. But and actually, ironically, the one of the things that happened in the 50s was that the Catholic press would champion Catholic causes by telling us how many people did what. So they would say, there's a big Eucharistic rally, 100,000 people came to the rally, and that just proves that, you know, this is a great thing. But those numbers, even though they were still celebrated, they started to shrink. But nobody ever said, hey, that's less than last year. They just said, isn't this great? We have 35,000 people showing up at the... So when I was reading through and collecting all this information, I said, 30,000 people in 1955 at a Eucharistic rally, that seems great. But in 1950, they had 80,000 people. So what happened? Like, that's a big drop-off, seemingly. To go unnoticed, it seems like a big drop-off. And then I looked at other devotions. I could see, okay, I look at the Our Lady of Perpetual Help Novena at St. Philomena Parish, which is a Redemptorist parish in Pittsburgh. Since been closed, but at that time it was a base for missionary operations throughout the three-state area here. But they had a very popular novena to Our Lady of Perpetual Help. Their attendance started to decline pretty dramatically through the 50s, mid-50s to the 60s and the 70s. And so what I started to see was a trend happening at about in the middle 1950s, a decline in lay participation in these pretty significant devotional activities. I thought, well, wait a second, this is not the story that I even understood a year ago. I thought we saw the laity chugging along in roughly the same way from 1870 to 1962, and then Vatican II came and changed all that. But what we really saw was a dramatic transformation in the way that they began to experience Catholicism. And part of that, so the big question became, why did that happen? What are the explanations for the changes, and what does that change mean? Is that a secularization? Are they leaving the church? Are they experiencing the church differently? Are they seeking different kinds of things from the church and therefore participating differently in the official activities? And my explanation in the 50s and 60s clearly is lay Catholics are not becoming secular. They're not rejecting Catholicism. They're seeking to experience their Catholicism in different ways. And the great, I don't want to say tragedy, but the sadness is that I don't think the official church recognized that through the 50s. And so they continued to prescribe a way of being Catholic that resonated very powerfully with the laity in the 1940s and 30s, but really had ceased to be, or had less and less been significant for Catholics in the 1950s. And so Vatican II came at a really important moment because it caught the laity in that transformation, and it allowed American Catholics, just as it allowed Catholics all over the world, to try and reimagine, okay, what might this church be like in this new time, in this modern era, where the old forms aren't resonating as powerfully as they did at one time.
Well, as you discovered that people were experiencing Catholicism in a different way at that time, before the Council took place, you were noticing a change in devotional practices. What is the change? A change to before the Council?
Yeah, that's the big question. I don't know that we have a really good answer to that. But I can give you a couple of tentative answers to that. One is that even though we saw a decline in devotions, we didn't see a decline in mass attendance. In fact, it looks like maybe an increase in mass attendance. So in the 50s, I think the 1958, we see 75% nationally, 75% of Catholics who are polled say they go to church every Sunday, and they receive communion when they go to church. And so we see a real engagement in mass. That's clearly very important to Catholics. And it's unfortunately, that's the first real measure of attendance that we have. We can't give you a number from before, but clearly that's not a decline. That's as high as we've got a record ever for 1958. So,
yes.
So it seems like, okay, mass is really important. And I think there's a movement, and this, I can't give you great numbers for this, but I can give you from anecdotal interviews with people, there was a change in the way that people oriented themselves toward mass. They started using in greater numbers missals so they could follow the Latin mass in translation. Yeah, so there were three or four really popular, well-celebrated St. Joseph's Missal and some others that really people started to buy and to carry in, almost like a feeling of pride, like I'm carrying the missal, that's how good of a Catholic I am. I'm getting engaged in this mass, and I'm trying to be involved in it. And we have the GI Bill that sent a lot of Catholics to college, and so you have generations now of Catholics coming out who are highly educated, who are ardent Catholics. They didn't lose their faith in college, they were affirmed in their faith, and they say, what can we do in the parishes now? We're educated, we're enthusiastic, you know, what's here for us to do? And the answers they're getting are, well, why don't you carry the banner in the Holy Name parade? Why don't you do, and they're saying, okay, that's not enough. Like, we want something more. We want something that resonates. And I don't have a great answer for what that would be or what they wanted it to be in the 1950s. I do get a sense in the 1960s what it is that they sought from their church, because we have this wonderful survey of Catholics in the Pittsburgh Diocese.
But clearly your work in this book takes you in the direction of the laity and the lay voice as a key phenomenon.
Sure.
What were you finding already in the 1950s about the lay voice in the church?
Well, I was finding a great desire to have a powerful voice in the church, to be more engaged, to be participate more in at least parish life and the governance of schools. And we saw a lot of social transformations happening in the 50s. We saw a great rise of Catholics getting college education. We saw a more affluent church. We saw the explosion of suburban life in the 1950s. And so we have a lot. And then we saw, perhaps most profoundly, women going to work outside the home much more in the 50s than we saw in earlier decades. So we see a whole bunch of social trends happening. And so I think the Catholic laity is saying, okay, what would this new form of our religious lives be like in a suburban parish where we don't have a long history of devotions to particular saints? We don't have the architecture that supports that with 20 or 30 statues of saints or side altars in these large parishes. We have a much more modern architecture. We have a much more young, almost everybody's of the same age, young families, young adults. We don't have three generations attending the same church anymore. Now everybody's in their 20s and they have kids who are in, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old. So we've got a different kind of Catholic laity going to these suburban parishes. And they're looking to be very engaged. They're raising money to build parishes. They're consulting with the architects. They've become a bigger voice in the way that the parishes are run. Not nearly to the extent they would be in the 60s, but they're coming, I think, to hope for and in some ways experience a greater more prominent voice in the lives of the local parish. So we see that they want that. We see that they don't have the same kind of time to allow, you know, women were the backbone of devotional activities. If they're at work, they can't do that. And so we do see a structural change in what's available to them and what they can do. And so they can't do the perpetual adoration. They can't come to the novenas as often as they used to, just because they're working and because these suburban parishes don't offer the same rich array of those kinds of activities as well. So we see shifts. I think we see the laity looking to have a bigger role, not quite sure what that role would be, not quite sure how to define this new experience, but looking for something that's different than the way of being Catholic that would have been practiced for decades before that.
And what is the significance of this? The fact that that there was a kind of a movement or that there was a development taking place that was maybe later confirmed at Vatican II, but that actually preceded Vatican II, you're saying, with regard to the lay voice and the way devotions are practiced and other things in the church. What is the significance of the fact that it began much earlier than the Council? Why is this a good thing for us to know?
Well, I think it's good to know because it allows us to see the laity in some ways trying to shape that transformation. Rather than just reacting to a transformation that's imposed from above, we see the laity in a sense saying we want to take part in this transformation. We want to shape it in a particular way. And we get glimpses of what that new church might be like if the laity had a lot of, authority or power or ability to shape that more than they did have. They did have some power to do that, but they didn't have a lot. And so we get glimpses of what the laity wanted. What kind of church did they want? If we recognize that they're already moving in a particular direction before the council. They're not just responding to it. I can think the old way of understanding that would have been, okay, we have the liturgical changes, so the laity are either unhappy or happy. They're responding to those changes that are happening. And we have the emergence of parish councils, and the laity are either responsive or indifferent to that. So we see the impetus for all these changes coming from above, and in this old way of understanding it. And so we say Catholics are, the laity is responsive or not, depending upon how well the priests can generate interest and that sort of thing. But if we take the other perspective, which is the laity are already moving toward change, then the question becomes, how do they shape the parish councils? How does their voice help to shape the new liturgy? How does their interest help to move the church in a particular kind of direction? And there's still tension about those changes. I don't want to downplay that at all. I think that there are a lot of Catholics who still would prefer the old way, who are still very attached to devotions, and some of those disappeared faster than people were letting go of them. But for most Catholics, it seems as though they were moving in a different direction.
Am I understanding you correctly, then, in a sense you're saying we need to know that the reason lay people are active in the church today is not simply because Vatican II somehow gave them permission, but rather this was something that was growing up out of the soul of the laity already before Vatican II.
Before Vatican II, yeah, I think that's an accurate depiction.
I'd like to add to that, though. I in the 50s, I was in a major seminary, and one of the things that was happening, we had a group of young seminarians who we called shakers, movers and shakers, and they were reading the literature that was coming out of Europe and different places like that, and there was this intellectual movement, which was, I think Eve Congar was one.
Sure, yeah.
Propelling this, and they were beginning to read this material and to move, and Maria del Lac was where the Benedictines had changed the liturgy around way back with Romano Guardini, and actually Ratzinger was one of these movers and shakers in his earlier days.
You see that movement very powerful, the sort of liturgical reform movement, which wasn't advocating at that moment, oh, let's go to the vernacular. That was a huge change, but there were, I think you're right, they were seeking, my reading of this, which is perhaps not as insightful as yours, from the 50s would have been, there was an attempt to return to what authentic
yes.
practices of the early church.
You hit it right on the right. head. That was the word.
Yeah, and so I think that, you could take that and extrapolate that all over. I think the laity were looking for authentic experiences of Catholicism in all areas, particularly the liturgy.
And the architecture started to show that.
Yes.
That the plainness rather than the gaucheness
yeah.
of them.
Well, I think you're right. I think it was a focus on what they saw as the central of the Mass is about the Eucharist,
right.
and it's about
yeah,
Jesus, and we don't want people doing not extraneous, but things that are not focused on the central act of the Mass, right? So we don't want them looking at side altars. We don't want them doing these other things, rosaries in the back of the church facing away from the altar. And we want everybody to be focused on that central act of the liturgy. Yeah, and not only that, but I think coming out of that liturgy should therefore you should have a transformative experience in the liturgy, and you should go take that experience and transform the society that you live in. So the liturgy isn't just something that you compartmentalize over here. It's something that infuses your entire life and hopefully the broader society. And that was very exciting, I would imagine, as a seminarian.
It was.
You know, and people like Dorothy Day, for example, had risen up in the church in this country and had become recognized leaders of a way of being lay people in the world. This was clearly before the council, so it is the fact that someone like this rises up, does this reflect the soul of the laity or this development in the lay way of experiencing the church?
Yeah, I think she's both a reflection of and a shaper of that new way of understanding lay behavior. And Joe Canici has done wonderful research on looking at all of these strands pulling together, and he pulls them together to see, oh, there's a movement here. We've looked at them in isolation, but if you look at them all together, you can see that there is something swelling up from the ground, and Dorothy Day is a huge part of that.
Oh,
and the Reform movement, really at St. John's in
Collegeville was
a big part of that.
Deep.
And yeah, so we can see these strands coming together, and so as we see, oh, we do see a big change, we can find origins of that change in a lot of different areas where we wouldn't have noticed that 20, 25 years ago.
St. John's is my alma mater, by the way, and I can say that in 1960, going to Mass at St. John's, which would be before the Council began, or in 1961, all through that period when I was in college, you did not feel like a passive bystander at the Mass. That, you know, not everything had happened with the liturgy yet that was going to happen, but already the laity did not feel like bystanders, onlookers at the Mass, I would say.
Yeah. And I don't know if St. Vincent had that same experience. They had some pretty vibrant musicians here who were I think,
yeah.
helping to transform, like Rembrandt Wieglund even, who were helping to transform things. But St. John's was clearly the center of the liturgical movement in America, mm-hmm. I think.
Okay, can we conclude right here, right now, and we're going to pick up again. So thank you for this first interview.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.